Now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Jaina Orchard. Today I'll be reading from the book Tales of Wonder by Jane Yolen. The Moon Ribbon. There was once a plain but good-hearted girl named Silva, whose sole possession was a ribbon her mother had left her. It was a strange ribbon, the color of moonlight, for it had been woven from the gray hairs of her mother, and her mother's mother, and her mother's mother's mother before her. Silva lived with her widowed father in a great house by the forest's edge. Once the great house had belonged to her mother, but when she died, it became Silva's father's house to do with as he willed. And what he willed was to live simply and happily with his daughter, without thinking of the day to come. But one day, when there was little enough to live on, and only the great house to recommend him, Silva's father married again, a beautiful widow who had two beautiful daughters of her own. It was a disastrous choice. For no sooner were they wed when it was apparent that the woman was mean in spirit and meaner in tongue. She dismissed most of the servants and gave their chores over to Silva, who followed her orders without complaint. For simply living in her mother's house with her loving father seemed enough for the girl. After a bit, however, the old man died in order to have some peace, and the house passed on to the stepmother. Scarcely 2 days had passed, or maybe three, when the stepmother left off mourning the old man and turned on Silva. She dismissed the last of the servants without their pay. "Girl," she called out, for she never used Silva's name, "you will sleep in the kitchen and do the charring." And for that time on, it was so. So Silva swept the floor and washed and mended the family's clothing. She sewed and hoed and tended the fields. She ground the wheat and kneaded the bread, and she waited on the others as though she was a servant, but she did not complain. Yet late at night, when the stepmother and her own two daughters were asleep, Silva would weep bitterly into her pillow, which was nothing more than an old broom laid in front of the hearth. One day, when she was cleaning out an old desk, Silva came upon a hidden drawer, which she had never seen before. Trembling, she opened the drawer. It was empty, except for a silver ribbon, with a label attached to it. "For Silva," read the card, "the moon ribbon of her mother's hair." She took it out and stared at it, and all that she had lost was borne in upon her. She felt the tears start in her eyes, and so as not to cry, she took the tag off and began to stroke the ribbon with her hand. It was rough and smooth at once, and shone like the rays of the moon. At that moment, her stepsisters came into the room. "What is that?" asked one. "Is it nice? It's mine."
"I want it. I saw it first," cried the other.
The noise brought the stepmother to them.
"Show it to me," she said.
Obediently, Silva came over and held the ribbon out to her. But when the stepmother picked it up, it looked like no more than strands of gray hair woven together unevenly. It was prickly to the touch.
"Disgusting," said the stepmother, dropping it back into Silva's hand. "Throw it out at once."
"Burn it," cried one stepsister.
"Bury it," cried the other.
"Oh, please, it was my mother's. She left it for me. Please let me keep it," begged Silva. The stepmother looked again at the gray strand.
"Very well," she said with a grim smile. "It suits you." And she strode out of the room, her daughters behind her.
Now that she had the silver ribbon, Silva thought her life would be better. But instead it became worse. As if to punish her for speaking out for the ribbon, her sisters were at her to wait on them both day and night. And whereas before she had to sleep by the hearth, she now had to sleep outside with the animals. Yet she did not complain or run away, for she was tied by her memories to her mother's house. One night, when the frost was on the grass, turning each blade into a silver spear,
Silva threw herself to the ground in tears, and the silver ribbon, which she had tied loosely about her hair, slipped off and lay on the ground before her. She had never seen it in the moonlight. It glittered and shone and seemed to ripple. Silva bent over to touch it, and her tears fell upon it. Suddenly, the ribbon began to grow and change, and as it changed, the air was filled with a woman's soft voice speaking these words: "Silver ribbon, silver hair, carry Silva with great care, bring my daughter home." And there at Silva's feet was a silver river that glittered and shone and rippled in the moonlight. There was neither boat nor bridge, but Silva did not care. She thought the river would wash away her sorrows, and without a single word she threw herself in. But she did not sink. Instead, she floated like a swan, and the river bore her on past houses and hills, past high places and low. And strange to say, she was not wet at all. At last she was carried around a great bend in the river and deposited gently on a grassy slope that came right down to the water's edge. Silva scrambled up onto the bank and looked about. There was a great meadow of grass, so green and still it might have been painted on. At the meadow's rim, near a dark forest, sat a house that was like, and yet not like, the one in which Silva lived. "Surely someone will be there who can tell me where I am and why I have been brought here," she thought. So she made her way across the meadow, and only where she stepped down did the grass move. When she moved beyond, the grass sprang back and was the same as before. And though she passed larkspur and meadowsweet, clover and rye, they did not seem like real flowers, for they had no smell at all. "Am I dreaming?" she wondered, "or am I dead?" But she did not say it out loud, for she was afraid to speak into the silence. Silva walked up to the house and hesitated at the door. She feared to knock, and yet feared equally not to. As she was deciding, the door opened of itself, and she walked in. She found herself in a large, long, dark hall, with a single crystal door at the end that emitted a strange glow the color of moonlight. As she walked down the hall, her shoes made no clatter on the polished wood floor, and when she reached the door, she tried to peer through into the room beyond, but the crystal panes merely gave back her own reflection 12 times. Silva reached for the doorknob and pulled sharply. The glowing crystal knob came off in her hand. She would have wept then, but anger stayed her. She beat her fists against the door, and it suddenly gave way. Inside was a small room lit only by a fireplace and a round white globe that hung from the ceiling like a pale, wan moon. Before the fireplace stood a tall woman dressed all in white. Her silver white hair was unbound and cascaded to her knees. Around her neck was a silver ribbon. "Welcome, my daughter," she said. "Are you my mother?" asked Silva wonderingly. For what little she remembered of her mother, she remembered no one as grand as this. "I am, if you make me so," came the reply. "And how do I do that?" asked Silva. "Give me your hand." As the woman spoke, she seemed to move away. Yet she moved not at all. Instead, the floor between them moved and cracked apart. Soon they were separated by a great chasm, which was so black it seemed to have no bottom. "I cannot reach," said Silva. "You must try," the woman replied. So Silva clutched the crystal knob to her breast and leaped, but it was too far. As she fell, she heard a woman's voice speaking from behind her and before her and all about her. "Well done, well done, my daughter. You are halfway home." Silva landed gently on the meadow grass, but a moment's walk from her house. In her hand she still held the knob, shrunk now to the size of a jewel. The river shimmered once before her and was gone. And where it had been was the silver ribbon lying limp and damp in the morning frost. The door to the house stood open. She drew a deep breath and went in.
"What is that?" cried one of the stepsisters when she saw the crystalline jewel in Silva's hand.
"I want it," cried the other, grabbing it from her.
"I will take that," said the stepmother, snatching it from them all. She held it up to the light and examined it. "It will fetch a good price and repay me for my care of you."
"Where did you get it?" she asked Silva.
Silva tried to tell them of the ribbon and the river, the tall woman and the black crevasse, but they laughed at her and did not believe her. Yet they could not explain away the jewel. So they left her then and went off to the city to sell it. When they returned, it was late. They thrust Silva outside to sleep and went themselves to their comfortable beds to dream of their new riches. Silva sat on the cold ground and thought about what had happened. She reached up and took down the ribbon from her hair. She stroked it, and it felt smooth and soft and yet hard, too. Carefully, she placed it on the ground. In the moonlight, the ribbon glittered and shone. Silva recalled the song she had heard, so she sang it to herself. "Silver ribbon, silver hair, carry Silva with great care. Bring my daughter home." Suddenly, the ribbon began to grow and change, and there at her feet was a silver highway that glittered and glistened in the moonlight. Without a moment's hesitation, Silva got up and stepped out onto the road and waited for it to bring her to the magical house. But the road did not move. "Strange," she said to herself. "Why does it not carry me as the river did?" Silva stood on the road and waited a moment more. Then she tentatively set one foot in front of the other. As soon as she had set off on her own, the road set off too, and they moved together past fields and forests, faster and faster, until the scenery seemed to fly by and blur into a moon-bleached rainbow of yellows, grays, and black. The road took a great turning and then quite suddenly stopped. But Silva did not. She scrambled up to the bank where the road ended and found herself again in the meadow. At the far rim of the grass, where the forest began, was the house that she had seen before. Silva strode purposefully through the grass, and this time the meadow was filled with the songs of birds, the meadowlark and the bunting, and the sweet jug-jug-jug of the nightingale. She could smell fresh-mown hay and pungent pine. The door of the house stood wide open, so Silva went right in. The long hall was no longer dark, but filled with the strange moon glow. And when she reached the crystal door at the end and gazed at her reflection 12 times in the glass, she saw her own face set with strange gray eyes and long gray hair. She put her hand up to her mouth to stop herself from crying out, but the sound came through and the door opened of itself. Inside was the tall woman, all in white, and the globe above her was as bright as a harvest moon. "Welcome, my sister," the woman said.
"I have no sister," said Silva, "but the two stepsisters I left at home, and you are none of those."
"I am if you make me so."
"How do I do that?"
"Give me back my heart, which you took from me yesterday."
"I did not take your heart. I took nothing but a crystal jewel."
The woman smiled. "It was my heart."
Silva looked stricken. "But I cannot give it back. My stepmother took it from me."
"No one can take unless you give."
"I had no choice."
"There is always a choice," the woman said.
Silva would have cried then, but a sudden thought struck her. "Then it must have been your choice to give me your heart."
The woman smiled again, nodded gently, and held out her hand. Silva placed her hand in the woman's, and there glowed for a moment on the woman's breast a silvery jewel that melted and disappeared.
"Now will you give me your heart?"
"I have done that already," said Silva, and as she said it, she knew it to be true. The woman reached over and touched Silva on her breast, and her heart sprung out into the woman's hand and turned into two fiery red jewels. "Once given, twice gained," said the woman. She handed one of the jewels back to Silva. Only take care that you give each jewel with love." Silva felt the jewel, warm and glowing in her hand, and at its touch felt such comfort as she had not had in many days. She closed her eyes, and a smile came on her face, and when she opened her eyes, she was standing on the meadow grass, not 2 steps from her own door. It was morning, and by her feet lay the silver ribbon, limp and damp from the frost. The door to her house stood open. Silva drew in her breath, picked up the ribbon, and went in. "What has happened to your hair?" asked one stepsister. "What has happened to your eyes?" asked the other. For indeed, Silva's hair and eyes had turned silver as the moon. But the stepmother saw only the fiery red jewel in Silva's hand. "Give it to me," she said, pointing to the gem. At first Silva had held out her hand, but then quickly drew it back. "I cannot," she said. The stepmother's eyes became hard. "Girl, give it here."
"I will not," said Silva.
The stepmother's eyes narrowed. "Then you shall tell me where you got it."
"That I shall, and gladly," said Silva.
She told them of the silver ribbon and the silver road, of the house with the crystal door. But strange to say, she left out the woman and her words. The stepmother closed her eyes and thought. At last she said,
"Let me see this wondrous silver ribbon, that I may believe what you say."
Silva handed her the ribbon, but she was not fooled by her stepmother's tone. The moment the silver ribbon lay prickly and limp in the stepmother's hand, she looked up triumphantly at Silva. Her face broke into a wolfish grin. "Fool," she said, "the magic is herein. With this ribbon there are jewels for the taking." She marched out of the door, and the stepsisters hurried behind her. Silva walked after them, but slowly, stopping in the open door. The stepmother flung the ribbon down. In the early morning sun it glowed as if with a cold flame.
"Say the words, girl," the stepmother commanded.
From the doorway, Silva whispered, "Silver ribbon, silver hair, lead the ladies with great care, lead them to their home." The silver ribbon wiggled and writhed in the sunlight, and as they watched, it turned into a silver red stair that went down into the ground.
"Wait," cried Silva, "do not go."
But it was too late. With a great shout, the stepmother gathered up her skirts and ran down the steps, her daughters fast behind her. And before Silva could move, the ground had closed up after them, and the meadow was as before. On the grass lay the silver ribbon, limp and dull. Silva went over and picked it up. As she did so, the jewel melted in her hand, and she felt a burning in her breast. She put her hand up to it, and she felt her heart beating strongly beneath. Silva smiled, put the silver ribbon in her pocket, and went back into her house. After a time, Silva's hair returned to its own color, except for 7 silver strands. But her eyes never changed back. And when she was married and had a child of her own, Silva plucked the silver strands from her own hair and wove them into the silver ribbon which she kept in a wooden box. When Silva's child was old enough to understand, the box with the silver ribbon was put into her safekeeping, and she has kept them for her own daughter to this very day. You've been listening to a story from the book Tales of Wonder by Jane Yolen, published by Schocken Books. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Jaina Orchard.
now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Nikki Eisman. Today I'll be reading The Porcelain Man by Richard Kennedy. Once upon a time, at the edge of town, lived a harsh man with a timid daughter who had grown pale and dreamy from too much obedience. The man kept the girl busy and hardly ever let her go out of doors. "You're lucky to be inside where it's safe and sound," he would say to her. "It's dog-eat-dog out there. The world is full of bottle-snatchers, rag-mongers, and rat-robbers. Believe you me." The girl believed him. Each morning, the man left the house in his rickety wagon, pulled by his rackety horse. All day long, he would go up and down the streets of the town, into the countryside and to neighboring villages to find what he could find. He would bring home old broken wheels, tables and chairs with the legs gone from them, pots and pans with holes in them, scraps of this and pieces of that. His daughter would then mend and repair the junk during her long and lonely days inside the house, and the man would take the things away and sell them as second-hand goods. This is the way they lived. One morning, the man left the house and gave his daughter his usual instruction and warning. "If someone passes on the road, stay away from the windows. If someone knocks, don't answer. I could tell you terrible stories." Then he left, and the girl began to work on a broken lantern. Now this morning some good luck happened to the man. As he was passing a rich man's house, a clumsy kitchen maid chased two cats out the front door with a broom and knocked over a large porcelain vase. The vase rolled out the door and down the steps and path and shattered to pieces against a marble pillar near the roadway. The man stopped and watched. The maid closed the door. The man waited there for 10 minutes. No one came out. Then he leapt down from his cart and gathered up the broken porcelain. He set the pieces gently in his cart and hurried off towards his daughter. His daughter, as usual, was safe and sound inside. "This is fine porcelain," the man said. "Drop whatever you're doing and patch it up. We'll get a good price for it." It was early in the day yet, so the man left again to see what else he might find. He remembered to pause at the door and say, "Stay inside. Terrible things are going on out there. Dog eat dog, the devil take the hindmost, and so forth." Then he left. The girl turned a piece of porcelain in her fingers, admiring its beauty. She carefully laid the pieces on a blanket and got out the glue. Then, humming to herself and musing on fanciful thoughts in the way she had acquired from being so much alone, she began to put the pieces of porcelain together. She worked quickly and neatly, even though her thoughts were completely elsewhere. And at the end of a couple hours, she was amazed to see that she had just set the last piece in place on a full-sized porcelain man. And at that moment, the porcelain man spoke. "I love you," he said, taking a step towards the girl. "Gracious!" gasped the girl, snatching up the blanket and throwing it about the man. "Gracious!" she gasped again, as the porcelain man encircled her in his arms and kissed her. While this was happening, the girl's father returned to the house, and right at this moment he opened the door to the room. "Whoa!" he bellowed. He grabbed a chair, raised it above his head, and brought it down squarely on top of the head of the porcelain man with a blow that shattered him from head to toe and the porcelain pieces scattered over the floor. "God Almighty!" the man cried. "I fractured his skull!" The girl let out a wail, and the man dropped to his knees, stunned with a catastrophe. But the girl explained that it had not been a real man, but only one made of the porcelain. "A porcelain man who could move?" "And he could talk as well," said the girl. "Fantastic," said the man. "Quick, put him together again before you forget how you did it. I'll make a cage for him and take him to the county fair. I'll charge $1 to see him. He can learn to dance. I'll make a big sign saying, 'See the dancing pot,' or something like that. I'll make thousands. Quick, put him together again." So the girl collected the pieces on the blanket and slowly began gluing them together again. Her father sat down and watched her for a while, but he found it to be boring and dropped off to sleep. The girl worked on, very sad that the porcelain man would be taken away in a cage. She was so distressed by her thoughts that she did not notice until putting the last piece in place that she had built a small porcelain horse. And the horse neighed. The man woke up. "What's that?" he said. "That's no man, that's a horse. Now you'll just have to do it all over again, and this time concentrate." Saying this, the man took up the chair over his head so as to smash the horse. But the horse said to the girl, "Quickly, jump on my back." She did, and in a second the horse leapt out of the window with the girl, and they galloped across the countryside as the man stood waving the chair at them through the window and shouting words they could not hear. After running for several miles, the horse stopped in a small meadow in the center of which stood a tree. "Get down," said the horse. The girl did. "Now," said the horse, "I will run into the tree and break myself to pieces, and then you are to put me back together as a man again." Then the horse added, "Remember, I love you." And before the girl could say a word, the horse dashed towards the tree and crashed into it full gallop and broke into hundreds of pieces. The girl cried out and then sat down under the tree and wept, for she had no glue. Now on a path nearby came along a young man pushing a wheelbarrow. He stopped when he saw the girl by the tree and went to comfort her. "Don't cry," he said. "Here, let us gather up the pieces and put them in the wheelbarrow. Come along with me and we'll fix everything almost as good as new." So they loaded up the broken porcelain and they went to the man's cottage and spread the pieces out on a blanket. "It must have been a beautiful set of dishes," said the man, and he began to glue some pieces together. They talked as they worked and told each other all about themselves. The girl admired how well and quickly the young man worked with his hands, and in a short while they had put together 12 dishes, 8 saucers and teacups, 6 bowls, 2 large serving platters, a milk pitcher, and 2 small vases. They cooked supper then. Their eyes met often as they moved about. Now and again their hands touched, and they brushed against each other often as they moved about. They set the table with the porcelain ware, and when they were eating, the girl's plate whispered up at her, "I still love you."
"Hush," she said.
"I beg your pardon," the young man said. "Oh, nothing," said the girl. And they lived happily ever after. You've been listening to The Porcelain Man by Richard Kennedy, published by Little Brown and Company. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Caroline Griss. The executive producer is Carla Tanella, and I'm Nikki Eisman.
Now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Bill McDermott. Today I'll be reading from the book Just So Stories by Rudyard Kipling. The Elephant's Child. In the high and far-off times, the elephant, O best beloved, had no trunk. He had only a blackish, bulgy nose, as big as a boot, that he could wriggle about from side to side, but he couldn't pick up things with it. But there was one elephant, a new elephant, an elephant's child, who was full of satiable curiosity. And that means he asked ever so many questions. And he lived in Africa. And he filled all of Africa with his satiable curiosities. He asked his tall aunt, the ostrich, why her tail feathers grew just so, and his tall aunt, the ostrich, spanked him with her hard, hard claw. He asked his tall uncle, the giraffe, what made his skin spotty, and his tall uncle, the giraffe, spanked him with his hard, hard hoof. And still he was full of satiable curiosity. He asked his broad aunt, the hippopotamus, why her eyes were red, and his broad aunt, the hippopotamus, spanked him with her broad, broad hoof. And he asked his hairy uncle, the baboon, why melons tasted just so, and his hairy uncle, the baboon, spanked him with his hairy, hairy paw. And still he was full of satiable curiosity. He asked questions about everything that he saw or heard or felt or smelt or touched, and all his uncles and aunts spanked him, and still he was full of satiable curiosity. One fine morning, in the middle of the precession of the equinoxes, this satiable elephant's child asked a new fine question that he'd never asked before. He asked, "What does the crocodile have for dinner?" Then everybody said, "Hush!" in a loud and dreadful tone, and they spanked him immediately and directly without stopping for a long time. By and by, when that was finished, he came upon Colocolo Bird sitting in the middle of a wait-a-bit thorn bush, and he said, "My father has spanked me, and my mother has spanked me. All my aunts and uncles have spanked me for my satiable curiosity. And still, I want to know what the crocodile has for dinner." Then Colocolo Bird said with a mournful cry, "Go to the banks of the great gray, green, greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees, and find out." That very next morning, when there was nothing left of the equinoxes, because the procession had proceeded according to precedent, this satiable elephant's child took 100 pounds of bananas, the little short red kind, and 100 pounds of sugar cane, the long purple kind, and 17 melons, the greeny crackly kind, and said to all his dear families, "Goodbye. I am going to the great gray, green, greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees, to find out what the crocodile has for dinner." And they all spanked him once more for luck, though he had asked them most politely to stop. Then he went away, a little warm, but not at all astonished, eating melons and throwing the rind about, because he could not pick it up. He went from Grahamstown to Kimberley, and from Kimberley to Kama's country, and from Kama's country he went east by north, eating melons all the time, till at last he came to the banks of the great gray, green, greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees, precisely as Colocolo Bird had said. Now you must know and understand, O best beloved, that till that very week and day and hour and minute, this satiable elephant's child had never seen a crocodile and did not know what one was like. It was all his satiable curiosity. The first thing that he found was a bicolored python rock snake curled around a rock. "Excuse me," said the elephant's child most politely, "but have you seen such a thing as a crocodile in these promiscuous parts?"
"Have I seen a crocodile?" said the bicolored python rock snake in a voice of dreadful scorn. "What will you ask me next?"
"Excuse me," said the elephant's child, "but could you kindly tell me what he has for dinner?"
Then the bicolored python rock snake uncoiled himself very quickly from the rock and spanked the elephant's child with his scalesome, flailsome tail.
"That is odd," said the elephant's child, "because my father and my mother and my uncle and my aunt, not to mention my other aunt, the hippopotamus, and my other uncle, the baboon, have all spanked me for my satiable curiosity, and I suppose this is the same thing." So he said goodbye very politely to the bicolored python rock snake, and helped to coil him up on the rock again, and went on, a little warm, but not at all astonished, eating melons and throwing the rind about because he could not pick it up, till he trod on what he thought was a log of wood at the very edge of the great gray, green, greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees. But it was really the crocodile, O best beloved, and the crocodile winked one eye like this.
"Excuse me," said the elephant's child most politely, "but do you happen to have seen a crocodile in these promiscuous parts?"
Then the crocodile winked the other eye
and lifted his tail out of the mud, and the elephant's child stepped back most politely because he did not wish to be spanked again. "Come hither, little one," said the crocodile. "Why do you ask such things?" "Excuse me," said the elephant's child most politely, "but my father has spanked me, my mother has spanked me, not to mention my tall aunt the ostrich and my tall uncle the giraffe, who can kick ever so hard, as well as my broad aunt the hippopotamus and my hairy uncle the baboon, and including the bicolored python rock snake with the scalesome, flailsome tail just up the bank, who spanks harder than any of them. And so, if it's quite all the same to you, I don't want to be spanked anymore." "Come hither, little one," said the crocodile, "for I am the crocodile." And he wept crocodile tears to show it was quite true. Then the elephant's child grew all breathless and painted and kneeled down on the bank and said, "You are the very person I've been looking for all these long days. Will you please tell me what you have for dinner?" "Come hither, little one," said the crocodile, "and I'll whisper." Then the elephant's child put his head down close to the crocodile's musky, tusky mouth, and the crocodile caught him by his little nose, which up to that very week, day, hour, and minute had been no bigger than a boot, though much more useful. "I think," said the crocodile, and he said it between his teeth like this, "I think today I will begin with elephant's child." At this, O best beloved, the elephant's child was much annoyed, and he said, speaking through his nose like this,
"Let go! You're hurting me!"
Then the bicolored python rock snake scuffled down from the bank and said, "My young friend, if you do not now, immediately and instantly, pull as hard as ever you can, it is my opinion that your acquaintance in the large patterned leather ulster," and by this he meant the crocodile, "will jerk you into yonder limpid stream before you can say, 'Jack Robinson.'" This is the way that bicolored python rot snakes always talk. Then the elephant's child sat back on his little haunches and pulled and pulled and pulled, and his nose began to stretch, and the crocodile floundered into the water, making it all creamy with great sweeps of his tail. And he pulled and pulled and pulled, and the elephant's child's nose kept on stretching, and the elephant's child spread all his little four legs and pulled and pulled and pulled, and his nose kept on stretching, and the crocodile threshed his tail like an oar, and he pulled and pulled and pulled, and at each pull the elephant child's nose grew longer and longer, and it hurt him hijus. Then the elephant child felt his legs slipping, and he said through his nose, which was now nearly 5 feet long,
"This is too much for me."
Then the bicolored python rock snake came down from the bank and knotted himself in a double clove hitch round the elephant's child's hind legs and said, "Rash and inexperienced traveler, we will now seriously devote ourselves to a little high tension, because if we do not, it is my impression that yonder self-propelling man of war with the armor-plated upper deck," and by this, O best beloved, he meant the crocodile, "will permanently vitiate your future career." That is the way all bicolored python rock snakes always talk. So he pulled, and the elephant's child pulled, and the crocodile pulled, but the elephant's child and the bicolored python rock snake pulled hardest. And at last, the crocodile let go of the elephant's child's nose with a plop that you could hear all up and down the Limpopo. Then the elephant's child sat down most hard and sudden, but first he was careful to say thank you to the bicolored python rock snake. And next he was kind to his poor pulled nose and wrapped it all up in cool banana leaves and hung it in the great gray-green greasy Limpopo to cool. "What are you doing that for?" said the bicolored python rock snake. "Excuse me," said the elephant's child, "but my nose is badly out of shape and I'm waiting for it to shrink." "Then you will have to wait a long time," said the bicolored python rock snake. "Some people do not know what is good for them." The elephant's child sat there for 3 days waiting for his nose to shrink, but it never grew any shorter, and besides, it made him squint. For, O best beloved, you will see and understand that the crocodile had pulled it out into a really truly trunk, same as all elephants have today. At the end of the third day, a fly came and stung him on the shoulder, and before he knew what he was doing, he lifted up his trunk and hit the fly dead with the end of it.
"Vantage number one," said the bicolored python rock snake. "You couldn't have done that with a mere smear nose. Try and eat a little now."
Before he thought what he was doing, the elephant's child put out his trunk and plucked a large bundle of grass, dusted it clean against his forelegs, and stuffed it into his own mouth.
"Vantage number two," said the bicolored python rock snake. "You couldn't have done that with a mere smear nose. Don't you think the sun is very hot here?"
"It is," said the elephant's child, and before he thought what he was doing, he schlooped up a schloop of mud from the banks of the great gray-green greasy Limpopo and slapped it on his head, where it made a cool, schloopy, schlossy mud cap all trickly behind his ears.
"Vantage number three," said the bicolored python rock snake. "You couldn't have done that with a mere smear nose. Now how do you feel about being spanked again?"
"Excuse me," said the elephant's child, "but I should not like it at all."
"How would you like to spank somebody?" said the bicolored python rock snake.
"I should like it very much indeed," said the elephant's child.
"Well," said the bicolored python rock snake, "you will find that new nose of yours very useful to spank people with."
"Thank you," said the elephant's child. "I'll remember that, and now I think I'll go home to all my dear families and try." So the elephant's child went home across Africa, frisking and whisking his trunk. When he wanted fruit to eat, he pulled fruit down from a tree instead of waiting for it to fall as he used to do. When he wanted grass, he plucked grass up from the ground instead of going on his knees as he used to do. When the flies bit him, he broke off the branch of a tree and used it as a fly whisk. And he made himself a new, cool, slushy, squishy mud cap whenever the sun was hot. When he felt lonely walking through Africa, he sang to himself down his trunk, and the noise was louder than several brass bands. He went especially out of his way to find a broad hippopotamus, she was no relation of his, and he spanked her very hard to make sure the bicolored python rock snake had spoken the truth about his new trunk. The rest of the time he picked up the melon rinds that he'd dropped on his way to the Limpopo, for he was a tidy pachyderm. One dark evening he came back to all his dear families, and he coiled up his trunk and said, "How do you do?" They were very glad to see him and immediately said, "Come here and be spanked for your satiable curiosity." "Pooh," said the elephant's child, "I don't think you peoples know anything about spanking, but I do, and I'll show you." Then he uncurled his trunk and knocked two of his dear brothers head over heels.
"Oh, banana," said they, "where did you learn that trick? And what have you done to your nose?"
"I got a new one from the crocodile on the banks of the great gray-green greasy Limpopo River," said the elephant's child. "I asked him what he had for dinner, and he gave me this to keep."
"It looks very ugly," said his hairy uncle the baboon.
"It does," said the elephant's child, "but it's very useful." And he picked up his hairy uncle the baboon by one hairy leg and hove him into a hornet's nest. Then that bad elephant's child spanked all his dear families for a long time, till they were very warm and greatly astonished. He pulled out his tall ostrich ant's tail feathers, and he caught his tall uncle the giraffe by the hind leg and dragged him through a thorn bush, and he shouted at his broad aunt the hippopotamus and blew bubbles into her ear when she was sleeping in the water after meals. But he never let anyone touch Colo Colo Bird. At last things grew so exciting that his dear families went off one by one in a hurry to the banks of the great gray green greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees, to borrow new noses from the crocodile. When they came back, nobody spanked anybody anymore, and ever since that day, O best beloved, all the elephants you will ever see, besides all those that you want, have trunks precisely like the trunk of the satiable elephant's child.
You've been been listening to a story from the Just So Stories by Rudyard Kipling, published by Weathervane Books of New York. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tanella. And I'm Bill McDermott.